and a truth that phenomena are essentially empty, do not exist independently of their quality of and conditions. He says many of bring in his lectures and invariably brings up the subject of emptiness. He says over and over that everything that the Buddha taught to the initial idea of fusing emptiness with compassion. This is the formula for happiness. Emptiness plus compassion equals happiness. According to the Dalai Lama, we need to first achieve wisdom by seeing the world as it is. Wisdom implies clear vision. With wisdom, we view everything around us clearly.
Disc 4.
The beggars took little notice of the approaching Dalai Lama. Instead, their attention was intently focused on the half-dozen Tibetans lugging a large aluminum bucket of saffron rice toward them. With quick, practiced movements, two young men ladled generous portions into the proffered tin cups. This ritual was enacted twice a day.
Scampering on their hands and knees alongside the fast-moving Tibetans were five or six crippled boys, their matchstick legs waving rhythmically behind their skinny bodies like tails. The boys, too, would not go hungry, not while the Dalai Lama was in town.
At the entrance to the temple's inner sanctum, the Dalai Lama slipped off his plastic flip-flops and prostrated three times on a crimson silk blanket laid on the floor by his attendant. He then walked through a narrow passage into a small chapel dominated, at the far end, by a large statue of the Buddha. The Dalai Lama approached the throne, the statue towering above him. He prostrated three more times. A group of Sri Lankan monks, resplendent in their bright saffron robes, hovered nearby. They are the official guardians of the temple. A dozen high Tibetan lamas in maroon robes and a handful of Tibetan bodyguards were the only other people in the small room. The air was close, pungent with the heavy, sweet smell of incense and the sour, lingering body odor of countless worshippers. I stood wedged next to Senge Rabten, the Dalai Lama's chief bodyguard. The short, crew-cut karate expert got on his tiptoes and tried to adjust a wall-mounted fan. After some fumbling, he succeeded in directing a stream of stale air in the direction of the Dalai Lama. I could hear the sounds of the huge mob outside, kept in check by soldiers carrying automatic weapons. One of the Sri Lankan monks handed a lighted tinder to the Dalai Lama. Two purple candles, spiral in shape and fitted on brass receptacles, stood on a ledge before the statue. The Dalai Lama lit them carefully, one after another. He then looked up at the Buddha statue and raised his right hand in a gesture of homage. I squinted at the ancient stone statue, said to be sculpted some 1,700 years ago. When it was unearthed by 19th-century British archaeologists, its head had been severed from its body. They cemented it back on before installing the statue in the inner sanctum of the temple. I knew that when the Dalai Lama first laid eyes on this all-important image, he'd been disturbed to see the very visible joint. He made a sizable donation requesting that the image be painted over in gold. The Archaeological Survey of India protested, but in the end, religious sensibilities won out. The wall behind the statue was painted blue and bathed in soft light, giving the effect of a large window framing perfect blue sky. I tried without success to pick out the telltale crease around the statue's neck. The Dalai Lama walked back outside the chapel. He turned to his right and rounded the central tower of the temple. Just before he reached the temple gates, he abruptly changed course and broke off to the right, approaching a large throng of Tibetans straining against the security personnel. With his bodyguard beside him, he headed for a young man seated on the ground next to an old woman with broad Mongolian features, her hair in two long plaits. The young man, in his early 20s, had a cane in his hand. Somehow, although his eyes were open, the Dalai Lama had surmised that he was blind. The Tibetan monk bent down took the man's hand and spoke to him in his deep baritone. He wanted to know where the blind man had come from, whether he had received any medical treatment. I marveled at the Dalai Lama's uncanny ability to pick out the disenfranchised, the disabled, from giant crowds. I would later learn that the young man, Lobsang Thinley, had come with his mother from the Machen area of Amdo, part of the Chinese province of Qinghai in northeast Tibet. He had lost his sight at the age of 15 when he suffered a severe concussion after a fall. An operation had restored his sight partially, but before long his blindness returned. Over the years, his mother had tried desperately to find a cure for her son, taking him to major hospitals in Chengdu and Beijing, where he had another operation and was also treated with acupuncture and moxibustion. Nothing worked. The man's optical nerves were badly damaged, and he was told that he would never see again. When he heard that the Dalai Lama, for the first time in 15 years, would perform the Kalachakra initiation in Bodh Gaya in early 2002, the son was determined to go. He wanted to be near the Dalai Lama, to hear his teachings. Family and friends tried to dissuade him. The journey from northeast Tibet to Nepal and India through the Himalayas would be arduous and dangerous. But he refused to listen. His mother sold all her jewelry and cattle and borrowed from relatives to scrape together enough money for the trip. She still held out hope that her son would be cured one day. Maybe they might get lucky in India, the birthplace of Buddhism. After a brief exchange with mother and son, the Dalai Lama turned to leave. The young man held onto his hands for a few more moments, reluctant to let go. The Dalai Lama spoke to one of his aides. He wanted Dr. Setin Dorji Sadutshan, one of his personal doctors and the director of the Delek Hospital in Dharamsala, to examine the man to see if anything could be done. Then he left the Mahabodhi Temple and walked back to the Tibetan monastery. Chapter 12. Like Molding Clay. A couple of days after the Dalai Lama's encounter with the blind man in Bodh Gaya, I had dinner as usual in the small second-floor dining room of the Tibetan monastery. All the members of the Dalai Lama's entourage, from the secretary of the private office to the bodyguards, ate their meals there. Most evenings, the fare was traditional Tibetan dishes of plain dumplings and noodle soup with vegetables. As I started on the soup, Dr. Setin Dorji Sadutshan slid in beside me. We'd first met 2 years earlier in Spiti, an ancient Tibetan kingdom north of Dharamsala. Dr. Setin, as he is known, is intense and rail-thin. A permanent air of scholarly introspection clings to him, and he speaks in thoughtful and measured tones. He keeps mostly to himself, but he can be surprisingly gregarious at times. I asked him about the blind man Lobsang Thinley from Tibet. "I got the message from His Holiness," Dr. Setin told me. But before I could go and check on the blind man, someone came to me with a piece of news. A young Tibetan, a monk from the Drepung Monastery in South India, wanted to donate his eyes to the man. I stopped slurping my noodle soup. I looked around the room to see if others had heard, but no one had taken any notice. "Yes, it's amazing," the Harvard-educated doctor said. "I have never heard of such a thing before. Eye donations, yes, from dead people, but never from a living person." "Are the two men related?" I asked after a long pause. "They met on pilgrimage in Sarnath, just before taking the train together to Bodh Gaya. They knew each other for only a few days." "Have you met the young blind man?" I asked. "Yes. I went to the camp where the pilgrims from Tibet stay. There were 200 or 300 people living in canvas tents just behind the temple. They had all managed to get through the Himalayas to Nepal, and then bribed the border guards to let them into India. The blind man was in a tent together with 8 or 10 others. His mother cried the whole time I was there." "Did you check his eyes?" "No, it was impossible. The light was poor, and I didn't have any instruments with me." "Did you tell him about the monk's offer?" "He knew about it already. I told him that first he would have to have a thorough examination so that we could find out what's wrong with his eyes. And both men would need to be checked to see whether they were compatible, whether the transplant was possible. I resumed eating my soup. Dr. Settin stared into his own bowl of noodles. He had eaten very little of it. The blind man told me he had thought long and hard about the donation, he continued. Of course he was tremendously moved, but he said in the end he had to refuse. He has suffered tremendously over the years, and he simply can't bear the thought of another person going through the same agony. Dr. Settin told me he had gone the next day to the camp where the monks from Drepung Monastery stayed. He wanted to meet Siring Tundup, the man who had offered to donate his eyes. The monk was not in. Yesterday, I went to see His Holiness and told him about the monk's offer, Dr. Settin said. What was his reaction? It was one of the most precious moments in my life, Dr. Settin said quietly. Even before I had finished telling him about the monk, I could feel this great outpouring of empathy, of compassion welling up from deep within him. It was real, almost a physical thing. But he didn't say a word. My eyes started to tear up. I had never felt something like this before. Compassion so powerful, enveloping me, seeping into me. Compassion is a theme the Dalai Lama returns to over and over again. I don't believe I have ever sat through one of his lectures or teachings without hearing him go on at length about it. I also know he has meditated on compassion every morning without fail for the past half century. In an interview, I asked the Dalai Lama to give me his take on compassion. Lakdor, as usual, was by his side. Compassion is something like a sense of caring, a sense of concern for others' difficulties and pain, the Dalai Lama said. Not only family and friends, but all other people, enemies also. Now, if we really analyze our feelings, one thing becomes clear. If we think only of ourselves, forget about other people, then our minds occupy a very small area. Inside that small area, even tiny problem appears very big. But the moment you develop a sense of concern for others, you realize that, just like ourselves, they also want happiness. They also want satisfaction. When you have this sense of concern, your mind automatically widens. At this point, your own problems, even big problems, will not be so significant. The result? Big increase in peace of mind. So if you think only of yourself, only your own happiness, the result is actually less happiness. You get more anxiety, more fear. So this is what I think of as the compassionate effect. If you really want genuine happiness, then whatever method you use to get it is worthwhile. And the best method is, when you think of others, you'll be the first to get maximum benefit. I asked the Dalai Lama how he came by this understanding of compassion. I was 32 years old when I developed a strong experience of compassion, he told me. In 1967, I received teaching of Shantideva's Bodhisattva's Way of Life from a High Lama. Since then, I read and thought about compassion. My mind became close to it, my feeling about it very strong. Often, when I reflect on the meaning and benefits of altruistic mind, tears came. He turned to speak to Lakdor in Tibetan. Lakdor translated. Based on his own understanding, the development of compassion had been ongoing since that time. When he meditated on compassion, he would sometimes be filled with joy and appreciation, and there is a strong sense of concern for others accompanied by a feeling of sadness. Is there another watershed in your development of compassion after 1967? I asked the Dalai Lama. Continuous, he replied in English, before speaking to Lakdor in Tibetan. In the late 80s, His Holiness's experience of compassion getting stronger and stronger, Lakdor translated. I noticed the Dalai Lama was reluctant to speak to me directly about his spiritual achievements. Perhaps he was concerned that he gave the impression of boasting. He was obviously more comfortable talking through Lakdor.
"From that time, the sensation of compassion comes to you more easily?" I asked.
"Yes," the Dalai Lama said, adding something in Tibetan.
Lakdor started to translate.
"One thing. After developing this real experience with compassion, there were these frequent episodes of..."
"Conviction, more proper word," the Dalai Lama interrupted. "I cannot say real experience. Strong conviction."
"An indication of that strong conviction," Lakdor continued.
"Whenever he meditated or reflected on compassion, it would lead to powerful emotions, lead to tears during some public teachings or private study. And when His Holiness reflected on certain profound explanations on emptiness, this would also trigger a strong emotion."
"I think that strong conviction or strong emotions actually give more inner strength," the Dalai Lama explained.
"So when I face some problems or criticism, for example, sometimes baseless criticism from the Chinese, of course, a little irritation sometimes, but then he'll have this feeling of compassion for them," Lakdor translated. "He'll regret they're not making positive connection with him. But his sentiment is, although there is this negativity, may it also give positive fruit.
Another thing, His Holiness wants to emphasize that his development of compassion is a result of long practice."
"Hard work?" I offered.
"Not very hard work," the Dalai Lama said.
"I think early morning, I reflect on compassion about a few minutes. Some meditation, some analytic meditation. Of course, every morning, I take altruism vow. At that time, I reflect on compassion, recite some verses till I get some kind of strong feeling. Now, the understanding of emptiness helps a lot toward developing compassion."
"There's no doubt it reinforces compassion," the Dalai Lama said, punching the air several times with his right index finger.
Lakdor elaborated. "Emptiness allows us to have an understanding about ultimate reality. It helps us to appreciate the wisdom of interdependence, a fundamental law of nature. We gain an appreciation that we are basically related. It is because of this interrelatedness that we are able to empathize with the suffering of others. With empathy, compassion flows naturally. We develop genuine sympathy for others' suffering and the will to help remove their pain. Emptiness thus strengthens positive emotions like compassion."
Emptiness and compassion, wisdom and method. These are the twin pillars of the Dalai Lama's practice. Everything we need to know about spiritual practice. He often uses a metaphor to illustrate their central importance. Just as a bird needs two wings to fly, a person with wisdom and no compassion is like a lonely hermit vegetating in the mountains. A compassionate person without wisdom is nothing more than a likable fool. Both qualities are needed. They strengthen each other. Once we realize we are all interconnected, it is difficult not to feel some sense of compassion for the problems of our fellow human beings. And once we come by a feeling of compassion, we start to get a glimpse of the timeless truth of interdependence, of emptiness. The Dalai Lama looked thoughtful. After some time, he turned to me. His eyes sought mine.
"I think one thing I'm quite sure," he said.
"I can tell you, the twin practice of emptiness and compassion is..." Then he lapsed into Tibetan again. Lakdor translated.
"His Holiness can say with conviction, if you meditate on emptiness and compassion, so long as you make the effort, then His Holiness is sure that, day in and day out, you will get tangible benefit. Your whole attitude will change."
"I think these two practices quite clever," the Dalai Lama trailed off, not entirely satisfied that clever was the right word. He stared into space, his palms together in front of his face.
"I think effective. I think understanding emptiness makes things soft, then compassion makes new shape."
At the end of his last sentence, he clashed his palms together like cymbals.
Like molding clay, Lakdor volunteered.
These things about compassion are something living, according to my own experience, the Dalai Lama went on. I tell some of my experiences to other people, share some of my feelings, then other people understand. There is something real, something living. Otherwise, many people get impression. These are something like Buddhist heaven, just idea, just concept, not something living.
Almost like telling a fairy tale, Lakdor translated as the Dalai Lama rocked back and forth on his chair, his body racked with laughter.
Chapter 13. The Making of a Space Yogi. 5 Indian ninjas formed a human shield around the Dalai Lama as he trudged up the steep trail leading to Vulture's Peak, one of the key pilgrimage sites for Buddhists. These crack commandos, members of an elite unit in the Indian Army, were dressed immaculately in black. Long-sleeved cotton shirts, flowing headscarves, and crisply pressed pants. Each had a second scarf tied bank robber fashion around the lower part of his face, so that only his eyes were visible. All carried automatic weapons. 2 of them, specially trained sharpshooters, had precision rifles slung on their shoulders. Even without their weapons, the broad-shouldered men were impressive-looking. Each stood over 6 feet tall and was obviously immensely fit. More soldiers in khakis and blue berets trailed behind. I had never seen the Dalai Lama so well protected in India. It was a rare event for the Tibetan leader to be visiting this out-of-the-way pilgrimage site in Bihar, the poorest, most anarchic state of the country. The authorities were leaving nothing to chance. The Dalai Lama climbed slowly but steadily, leaning with deliberation into a walking stick fashioned from a scrawny-looking branch. From time to time he chatted briefly with his Indian escorts, but mainly he kept to himself. A quarter of the way up, he took off his maroon outer shawl and handed it to Pochung, his attendant, who folded it carefully into a square packet. At one point, the Dalai Lama walked a few steps off the path to look at a small meditation cave dug into the side of the hill. A disciple of the Buddha had cloistered himself there in meditation 2.5 millennia ago. By the time we reached the top of the Vulture's Peak, the Dalai Lama was sweating. He stopped, reached inside his monk's tunic, and pulled out a tissue, dabbing his forehead and face with it. Bowing slightly, Tenzin Takla, close at hand as always, held out a hand for the used wipe. But the Dalai Lama put it back inside his tunic. The top of the Vulture's Peak was a handkerchief-sized piece of flat ground hemmed in by rocky outcrops on 3 sides. On the 4th, the knife-edged ridge drops steeply down a valley. A U-shaped brick enclosure, built to waist height, dominated the flat area. Numerous offering candles had been placed on top of the enclosure's low walls. After prostrations, the Dalai Lama walked to the edge of the ridge and looked down onto the flat valley of Rajgir, 3 hours' drive from Bodh Gaya. A lone red dirt road bisected the verdant farmland, leading straight to the high mountains ringing the valley. The view was gorgeous, but the Dalai Lama didn't linger over it. His mind was on the prayers, the wisdom sutras explaining the concept of emptiness that he had come to recite. It was on this spot that 2,500 years ago the Buddha expounded the doctrine of emptiness, an idea that lies at the heart of Buddhist knowledge. In previous meetings with me, the Dalai Lama had explained at length the interrelated concepts of interdependence and emptiness. They are the 2 sides of the same coin, 2 different ways to come to grips with the same idea. This is what he has told me. The existence of anything, coffee mugs, feelings of jealousy, is totally dependent on a complex web of relationships. Because of this, if you think about it long enough, there is no logical way for these things to exist independently. Therefore, in the Dalai Lama's terminology, they are said to be devoid of a life of their own. They have no inherent existence. In other words, they are empty. He had also told me that, to fully appreciate these central concepts, to transcend mere intellectual understanding, a rigorous spiritual practice involving long periods of meditation is indispensable. In another interview, I wanted to know how the Dalai Lama first encountered the concept of emptiness and how it has subsequently assumed such pivotal importance in his life. "Emptiness is not an easy thing to understand," the Dalai Lama told me. "But once I developed some understanding, some direct insights, then I realized it is applicable to almost all experiences, all situations." He turned to Lakdor and spoke to him in Tibetan. Having gained more knowledge with growing age, the influence of emptiness on his life becomes more pronounced, Lakdor translated. "I think around 20 years old, I already developed genuine interest in emptiness," the Dalai Lama continued, rocking backward and forward gently on the edge of his chair. "I remember one incident. In 1954, I attended the National People's Congress in Peking. There were some days without much engagements, so I asked to study emptiness with Ling Rinpoche, my senior tutor. That was one indication of my interest." The Dalai Lama fell silent. His rhythmic rocking stopped. He sat ramrod straight and stared into the distance. After a few moments, he scratched his chin and started to speak again in Tibetan to Lakdor, rubbing his right hand gently in a circular motion around his chest. Lakdor leaned far forward, his eyes fixated on the Tibetan leader as he translated. "It was in His Holiness's late 20s, in 1963. One day, he was reading a Buddhist text. At one point, he came across a line which says, 'I is merely designated to the self of physical aggregates, mental and physical collection.' As soon as he read that, he got a special kind of sensation, a strange experience." Lakdor's voice was a hoarse whisper. I had to strain to hear the words. "How long did that strange experience last?" I asked. "That feeling lasted, I think, few weeks maybe," the Dalai Lama replied. He spoke to Lakdor some more. The furrows on his brow lightened. He peered down at the floor in front of him and gestured to the carpet with a sweeping motion. There was a look of wonder on his face. "During this time," Lakdor translated, "whenever he saw people, things, carpet, for example, he would see them as carpet and people. But at the same time, he noticed that they have no essence. He had the distinct feeling that there is no I. Not in the sense that I do not exist, but a certain feeling of no I as we understand it." "Absence of solid reality," the Dalai Lama said emphatically. He raised both his hands to chest level and clenched them into tight fists. "Did you have any visions?" I asked tentatively, unsure of the wisdom of pursuing this line of questioning. I had just realized that the conversation had taken an unexpected turn. The Dalai Lama was telling me something very personal, something perhaps only a handful of people had ever heard. "No," he answered. "But there was this experience of no I," I said. "Yes." The Dalai Lama again spoke directly to Lakdor. "Physically, something like lightning surged through his heart," Lakdor translated. "He experienced something like an electric shock." I had the uncomfortable sensation that I was eavesdropping. Spiritual realizations are intimate, personal experiences for a Buddhist, and this was the first time I had ever heard a serious practitioner talk about them. But I needed to confirm what I'd just heard. "An electric shock going through your body?" I asked the Dalai Lama. "Yes," he replied. He was watching me closely, his hands clasped now on his lap. I heard a soft click, a sound that seemed to come from far away. Then I realized my tape recorder had stopped. The tape was finished. I kept my eyes fixed on the Dalai Lama, not trusting my ability to fish a new tape from my day pack. I'd get a copy of the interview from Lakdor later. In those few weeks, you saw objects as without essence, without substance? I asked.
The Dalai Lama sat very straight in his chair, his face impassive. It occurred to me he looked very much like a Buddha at that moment. I couldn't help feeling awed by his presence.
Yes. If I thought about non-self, no I, he elaborated, then in that one moment, just like picture. I think it is similar to watching TV or a movie. It is especially like watching a movie. One way to look at the movie, feeling something real going on in there. But at the same time, while your eye is looking there, your mind knows this is mere picture, acting, not real. So, seeing same picture, one, without understanding this is acting, another, seeing but still feel this is acting.
The Dalai Lama was telling me that his way of seeing had changed after the strange experience of 1963. He saw that things now appeared to have two facets. One, solid, real, touchable, the kind of everyday things we encountered, fridge, anger, neighbors. Second, the underlying unreal nature of things, things that are like a picture show, their essences nothing but flickering technicolor mirages on a widescreen. Their existence, characterized by constant change and impermanence, depends on a web of relationships. All things, fridge, anger, neighbors, can be viewed in these two perspectives. The influence of the 1963 incident stayed with him, the Dalai Lama told me. As he continued with his practice and meditated on a daily basis, his spiritual insights came about with more frequency. Whenever the thought of self or I flashed across his mind, it was likely to be accompanied by a sensation of emptiness, of no I. Previously, the Dalai Lama said, unless I think seriously and continuously, at least for a few minutes, it was difficult to get that kind of feeling. Nowadays, as soon as I remember about emptiness, the picture becomes clearly different. Is this a stronger realization of emptiness? I asked. Yes, the Dalai Lama said. Then he promptly backtracked. Emptiness, I don't know. I had the feeling he wanted to be very careful about this. What's the importance in seeing the intangible in things? What has that got to do with your life? I asked. The Dalai Lama spoke to Lakdor. Normally, we tend to see things in a solid, tangible way, Lakdor translated. Therefore, there is a tendency to grasp at things, to become attached to things. We cling to the idea of a separate self and separate things. We strive for new experiences, new acquisitions. Yet, as soon as we possess them, the buzz is gone, and we look for something new. This endless cycle of craving brings suffering. In His Holiness's case, this grasping attitude does not arise. This is because the self, wishes, desires, or Rolex watches are perceived ultimately by Him as impermanent, changing, elusive, empty. Like mirages, they are not quite real. There is no way you can truly hang on to them. Therefore, there is no point to covet them. If we acquire an understanding of emptiness, craving, the source of our suffering, is lessened. The Dalai Lama lapsed into Tibetan once again. Something had tickled his funny bone. He launched into one of his full-body laughing fits, waggling his head from side to side. His face was so crunched up with mirth that his eyes disappeared. His Holiness says he's boasting, and he says this is called a fool trying to fool others, Lakdor said with a big smile. We said nothing for a while. I looked over the notes I jotted down. The interview was veering into a direction I had not expected. A new thought occurred to me, and I asked the Dalai Lama, did you ever talk to anyone about your spiritual accomplishment? In the early 70s, he replied, I told Ling Rinpoche, almost like report, about my understanding of emptiness. Then he trailed off, turning to speak to Lakdor in Tibetan. Ling Rinpoche commented that very soon
His Holiness will become a space yogi, Lakdor translated. A space yogi is a practitioner who realizes space-like emptiness, someone who has achieved substantive enlightenment. Did you get into that state? I asked, throwing caution to the wind.
I don't know, the Dalai Lama said.
I noticed that he seemed to be twiddling his thumbs, but after a second I realized that his hands, resting comfortably on his lap, were rhythmically clicking the beads of an imaginary rosary. He spoke to Lakdor again. All the time he's making progress, Lakdor translated. His Holiness is quite sure about one thing. If Ling Rinpoche was still alive today, and His Holiness told him about his spiritual attainment, Ling Rinpoche would definitely be pleased.
There is a reason why His Holiness is explaining all this to you, Lakdor said unprompted.
Normally, it is totally improper to talk about these things.
That's right. That's right. Therefore, whenever I explain some of my experiences about compassion and my understanding of emptiness, I always make clear, the Dalai Lama said. He switched to Tibetan and spoke directly to Lakdor.
His Holiness sometimes talks about his spiritual development to inspire people, Lakdor translated. But he always concludes by saying, I'm not saying I'm Bodhisattva. I'm not saying I've realized emptiness.
His Holiness also makes this point. From his own experience, he notices that one can always make progress. Therefore, he would tell his audience, in my own case also, even though I am not a bodhisattva, have not cultivated bodhicitta, infinite altruism, but I am like someone who can now see the top of the mountain.
The Dalai Lama interjected, not reach top, but now I get the feeling. Oh, I can get there, he said and pinched his nose.
You can smell it, I suggested. The shadows were lengthening in the charming veranda outside the room. The Dalai Lama looked at his watch and said to me,
Now 5 more minutes.
I had been with him for nearly 2 hours, but I felt a slight panic coming on. I still had a page and a half of questions to go. As I considered my next question, Lakdor turned to look at me and said, There is always some danger talking about things like spiritual development.
Danger?
I was nonplussed. I was also surprised that Lakdor had offered up this caution on his own and in the presence of the Dalai Lama. It was his habit to remain silent unless he was called upon to translate.
If you say you have realized emptiness while in actual fact you have not attained that state, Lakdor explained.
The danger is this, the Dalai Lama elaborated. Although I do not have that intention, on the basis of my statement, someone believes I've attained some higher state. If he believes it out of faith, maybe all right. But if he believes it because of my statement, and then if I feel... He paused.
Lakdor completed the thought for the Dalai Lama. If His Holiness feels it is okay, it is fine that he gets such an idea, then there is a risk.
So there is some selfish motivation now, the Dalai Lama added.
As I had been at other times, I was struck by how unflinchingly the Dalai Lama examines his motivation for every act. It is a conditioned response. It happens every time he opens his mouth or makes a decision.
Lie, of course, whether layperson or monk, everyone lying is sin.
Negative, the Dalai Lama continued with heightened intensity. But I'm monk, fully ordained. If I tell others that I have some deep experience of spiritual realization, and knowing I have not that quality, that lie is one major lie. It is cause for disrobing, no longer monk.
It's not like telling a minor lie, it's a very big special lie, Lakdor added.
Like sexual misconduct, killing human beings, stealing, then this lie. The Dalai Lama said.
4 major ones, I said.
Then no longer is monk. Therefore it's dangerous, the Dalai Lama concluded. Our interview was at an end. The Dalai Lama walked over and gave me a hug. After he left the room, I started to gather up the things I'd strewn all over the coffee table, notebooks, sheaves of typed questions, photocopies of articles, tape recorder. Lakhdar hung around and helped me cram them into my day pack. We didn't make small talk as we usually did after a session. I felt drained, and he seemed to be as well. As we walked out of the audience room, Lakhdar gently touched my elbow. I turned to look at him. His face seemed soft, a touch vulnerable. "You know, Victor," he said to me quietly, "I've heard His Holiness touch on these subjects briefly before, but I've never heard him go into such detail, such depth. The monks and lamas in the monasteries wouldn't believe their ears if they heard that interview." His eyes sought out mine. "They'd be so inspired, so moved, they'd go crazy."
Chapter 14. White Kites Fluttering. I liked the hotel room. It was spacious and high-ceilinged, one of a few guest rooms in the circuit house, a colonial mansion used by Indian officials on government business in Rajgir, the small town near Vulture's Peak. It was the bathroom I didn't care for. There was no hot water, and the toilet was eastern, a hole in the floor. I have never developed the necessary leg muscles or the flexibility to cope with these contraptions. The room, however, opened onto a large veranda, furnished with a few rattan chairs and low tables. I could easily imagine sitting here at sunset, dressed in white linens, sipping an ice-cold gin and tonic garnished with a wedge of lime. I was staying at the circuit house courtesy of the private office of the Dalai Lama. The room charge was 10 rupees a night, 20 US cents, for which the government of India would duly invoice Dharmasala. I hadn't expected to spend the night here, but there had been a change of plan. For the last couple of weeks, I had accompanied the Dalai Lama on his pilgrimage to some of the most important Buddhist sites of India. After the strenuous walk up Vulture's Peak, the Dalai Lama had decided to go directly to a hotel in Patna, a 3-hour drive away. It would break up his long, uncomfortable journey back to Bodh Gaya along the notoriously bad roads of Bihar. He'd arrive rested and be better prepared to begin the great Kalachakra ritual before 200,000 pilgrims. I had decided against going with the Dalai Lama to Patna. I couldn't face such a long drive so late in the day. I shared the hotel room with Dr. Setin Dorji Sadutshan, one of the Dalai Lama's principal physicians. He joined me as I was getting ready for bed. He is by nature a quiet and reserved man, although he has always been friendly to me. We have a few things in common. Part of his family lives in Vancouver, my hometown, and we both have preteen children. We also enjoy long, thoughtful chats about the Dalai Lama. Before we turned off the lights, Dr. Setin told me why he was in Rajgir, why he had, on his own initiative, followed the Dalai Lama on his pilgrimage to Vulture's Peak and Nalanda. The roads are bad in these out-of-the-way places, and medical facilities are few and far between. So Dr. Setin had come along just in case. It wasn't easy to be the Dalai Lama's doctor, he confided. The Tibetan leader tends to get annoyed when his staff fusses over him. He rebels at the idea of having doctors around him when he travels. He believes that doctors should be serving the public rather than hovering at his elbow. Over the years, Dr. Setin has become reconciled to this, and he's learned to shadow his patient surreptitiously. By the time I woke up in the morning, Dr. Setin had already left the room. I took a bracingly cold shower, packed my things, and went out to the terrace. I sat down in a wing-backed wicker chair, enjoying the cool morning air. A thin wash of mist softened the red earth. A couple of street dogs, dead to the world after a night of adventures, were curled up in tight balls under a tree. All was quiet except for the birds. Suddenly, Dr. Setin bounded up the stairs, taking the steps two at a time. Without so much as a good morning, he said to me, "Okay, the car is here. We have to leave right away. There is no time for breakfast." He grabbed his stuff from the room and ran down the stairs. I followed closely behind. As we drove out of the circuit house compound, Dr. Setin filled me in. He had gotten an early morning call from Tenzin Takla,
His Holiness's deputy private secretary. The Dalai Lama had suffered from severe abdominal pain on the way to Patna and had spent the night there in the Maurya Hotel. He was in no condition to continue on to Bodh Gaya. After hanging up, Dr. Setien had called his colleagues, Dr. Namgyal and Dr. Dawa, specialists in Tibetan medicine who staffed a free clinic for pilgrims in Bodh Gaya. They too would head out to Patna immediately. The Maurya, sandwiched between a couple of seedy-looking apartment buildings, was the best hotel in Patna. Its small lobby was crowded with Indian journalists. This would be their command post as they waited for news about the Dalai Lama's condition. A bodyguard took Dr. Setien upstairs right away. I went to the restaurant for breakfast, then made my way up to the third floor. A phalanx of Tibetan security personnel hung around the corridor. Dr. Setien and Tenzin Takla were nowhere to be seen. The situation looked serious. I could see that the Dalai Lama's bodyguards were concerned. There was none of their usual banter. And all three of the physicians charged with looking after the Dalai Lama had come here to check on his condition. In all the years I have known him, since my first audience in 1972, the Tibetan leader had never been sick except for the occasional flu or upset stomach. The only time he'd been seriously ill was when he contracted hepatitis B in 1967. He had been laid up for a month then, and the exile community had been traumatized. Late that morning, I went back to Bodh Gaya without Dr. Setien. I was nagged by an uneasy feeling as my driver negotiated his way out of the heavy traffic of Patna. After 3 days of rest in Patna, the Dalai Lama's condition had not improved. He was flown to the small airport in Gaya by a government helicopter. From there he was driven the short distance to Shei Chen Monastery in the heart of Bodh Gaya. As he got out of the car unsteadily, he was welcomed by Chimela, the tall, big-boned daughter of the late Dilgo Khyentse Rinpoche, the legendary founder of the monastery. The Dalai Lama grabbed her left arm and leaned on her with all his weight as they shuffled to the entrance. Rabjam Rinpoche, the current abbot, averted his eyes. Tears rolled down his cheeks. He was devastated at how haggard the Dalai Lama looked. The 8-year-old incarnate Lama sat behind a low table draped with intricately patterned brocades. The vividness of the fabric's colors competed for attention with the profusion of flowers on the table. Yellow marigolds were piled on shallow copper dishes filled with water. Bunches of pink gladiolas were mixed with pale purple lilacs in a brass vase. An oversized backrest, on which embroidered dragons frolicked on surfaces of gold, dwarfed the young boy. Yangtze Rinpoche, resplendent in his yellow and maroon robes, carried himself like a prince on his throne. Flanked by Rabjam Rinpoche and other high lamas, he sat before a large assembly of Tibetan monks. They were gathered in the courtyard of the Mahabodhi Temple of Bodh Gaya to pray for the speedy recovery of the Dalai Lama. The ailing Tibetan leader had been in Bodh Gaya for a few days, and there were no signs that he was getting any better. A Tibetan monk wearing a white surgical mask approached the chubby-faced boy. He was holding a wire cage out in front of him. Inside the cage was a rose-ringed parakeet, a green bird the size of a small parrot. Bending low, the monk presented the cage to Yangtze Rinpoche, who leaned forward and blew on the creature, a benediction for a fellow sentient being. He then reached for the metal ring on top of the cage. The skittish bird suddenly flapped its wings violently, and the startled boy withdrew his hand in a hurry. The monk opened the door of the cage. The bird flung itself clumsily against the opening. There was a flash of green, and then it was off. The boy Lama, pleased with himself, stole a quick glance at Rabjam Rinpoche. The senior Lama had a big grin on his face. His young charge, with a little help, had just performed an act of merit that just might have an effect on the Dalai Lama's health. A group of elderly Tibetan pilgrims sat some distance away from me. One man was busy working his homemade prayer wheel, a thick wooden rod topped with a skirt of yellow cloth with prayers stenciled on it. He had stuck the rod into the ground and was twirling it in a clockwise direction, the skirt a yellow blur. The man seated next to him was craning his neck, following the trajectory of the freed bird for as long as he could. The Dalai Lama had not left his bedroom on the top floor of Shechen Monastery since he'd arrived from Patna. His doctors and his personal attendant of many years, Paljor La, were the only ones who had seen him. Tenzin Takla had taken to wandering vacantly around the monastic grounds with a folder full of documents, daily briefings, communications from the Tibetan cabinet and the private office, decisions that required the Dalai Lama's urgent attention. But there were no meetings, no audiences, no teachings with His Holiness. As he lay sequestered, 200,000 pilgrims poured into the small town where the Buddha had attained enlightenment. All of them were eager for a glimpse of the Dalai Lama and impatient for the great Kalachakra initiation to begin. Four Indian ninjas carrying automatic weapons jogged through the gate into the huge Kalachakra compound, their black headscarves streaming behind them. The white ambassador, carrying the Dalai Lama, slowly followed. The car came to a stop, and the Tibetan leader stepped out. I had not seen him for 10 days, and I was shocked. Instead of a vigorous man who could pass for someone in his mid-50s, he now looked every inch 67 years old. His shoulders more hunched than usual, the Dalai Lama waddled along the yellow carpet, a red carpet wrapped in yellow cotton, that had been laid out for him. As he arrived at a receiving line of monks and Tibetan officials, all holding bunches of incense, he scraped an index finger down his wan right cheek and said something to the nearest monk. I guessed he was asking if he had gotten thinner. There was no question that he had lost weight. The hollows in his cheeks were more pronounced. His eyes were sunken. As he walked past me, his face crinkled into a tentative smile. But I was acutely aware that he didn't have the energy to raise his hand in greeting, as was his custom. The Dalai Lama shuffled through the small Kalachakra chapel housing the sand mandala and out onto a large stage. 400 of the most senior monks from all four schools of Tibetan Buddhism were waiting patiently for his arrival. So was silver-haired actor Richard Gere, the only Westerner to have a seat on the stage. There had been an announcement 2 days earlier that the Dalai Lama would make a brief appearance at the Kalachakra grounds, his first public event since he'd fallen ill. Excitement had rippled through Bodh Gaya and beyond. Below the stage, a sizable contingent of journalists and TV crews jockeyed for a view of the ailing Tibetan leader. Little Yangtze Rinpoche, together with half a dozen incarnate lamas, sat in the front row. The Dalai Lama walked up to the boy and patted his head. As His Holiness started to climb the wooden steps leading to his throne, several pairs of hands grabbed his arms to steady him. A thick-set monk high-stepped to the top of the stairs for better leverage and physically pulled the weakened Dalai Lama up. The Tibetan leader stood a touch unsteadily on the thick cushion. Palms pressed together in front of his chest, he bowed solemnly to the giant crowd gathered before him. Hundreds of thousands of pilgrims from the entire arc of the Himalayas and the Indian subcontinent had squeezed into the makeshift compound, along with 2,000 Westerners from 50 countries. After he sat down, the Dalai Lama fumbled inside his robes and took out a piece of paper. That was unusual. He had always spoken extemporaneously. I looked away to scan the crowd below. Out of the corner of my eye, I saw something that looked like a white, elongated bird floating through the air above the large crowd of monks sitting below. One monk, without moving from his lotus position, had reached inside his satchel and taken out a kata, a white ceremonial scarf. He crumpled it into a ball and threw it out over the crowd. It sailed through the air gracefully, powered by a gust. A monk with a long goatee caught it in midstream, then hurled it farther. In no time, as if by some unseen cue, hundreds of soft silk cloth streaked across the air like so many silk kites, forming a shimmering, ever-changing web of white above a sea of red. Unable to get near the stage to physically present the scarves to the ailing Tibetan leader, the monks and pilgrims were doing the next best thing. The Dalai Lama sat hunched on his throne, taking in the scene. He took a deep breath, cleared his throat, and swallowed. He inhaled with effort a couple of times. I got the sense that it was an emotional moment for him, that he was deeply touched by the outpouring of concern from so many people. I would always remember those few seconds. The grounds were packed, but not a cough punctuated the silence. The Dalai Lama started to speak in Tibetan. His deep baritone was still there, but some of its splendor was missing. The illness had robbed him of much of his vitality. His translator, Lakdor, sat lotus-fashion on one corner of the stage, a small transmitter before him. As the Dalai Lama began to talk to the crowd, Lakdor spoke softly into his microphone in English. His words would be picked up by the Westerners with FM radios. "During the last few days, I have been quite sick," Lakdor translated. "Before that, although I had been healthy, many people had already suggested that I take more rest and not work as hard. I didn't pay much attention to them, so I was careless and a little stubborn." The Dalai Lama told the crowd about his pilgrimage to the Vulture's Peak and his exhausting climb to the top. He talked about the terrible pain he experienced during the drive to Patna. "I think I'm cured now, but I'm still very tired," he continued. "I don't think I will be able to give the preliminary teachings." I heard some sniffles through my headphones. I looked over at Lakdor. His head was bowed, and I could see that his face was flushed. "As for the Kalachakra initiation, it could be shortened to some extent, but its preparation takes at least 5 to 6 hours every day, even if I do it quickly. I don't think my present state of health would permit this." There were more sniffles. Lakdor stopped speaking entirely for a moment as he cleared his throat. "If I force myself to perform these preparations, this would be stubborn. So, for the sake of maintaining my health, to be able to work for the benefit of others over the long term, I have decided to postpone the Kalachakra until next year." On the stage, many of the high lamas and abbots were weeping openly. "Those of you who have come from far away, do not feel sad that you have not received the Kalachakra initiation," Lakdor translated. "You have come to this holy place with determination and the right motivation. You will accumulate merit with every step you take, every action you perform. The main source of blessing is not me, not the Dalai Lama. It is the holy image of the Buddha and the sacred ground visited by so many of the greatest spiritual masters. So, do not think that you have come here for nothing. Normally, you cannot view the mandala until after the initiations. However, since I am unable to confer them, this is a slight problem. But you have come to this holy place with great devotion, so I think it will be useful for you to see the mandala." The Dalai Lama paused to collect his thoughts. "Right now, funnily enough, my body seems to be improving as I speak to you. If my health does not deteriorate, I'll try to give some teachings for 2 days. And on the 15th day of the Tibetan month, I'll come back here for the last event of the Kalachakra, the long life empowerment." More Tibetans continued to arrive in Bodh Gaya as the day progressed. That night, the Mahabodhi temple appeared to be on fire, its myriad votive stupas and towers with intricate stone carvings were lit by 500,000 candles, each one an offering for the speedy recovery of the Dalai Lama. Tens of thousands of pilgrims shuffled clockwise in ritual circumambulation. From a distance, the circular precinct looked like a gigantic space station bathed in an otherworldly glow. I went back to the Kalachakra Chapel the following day. The monks from the Dalai Lama's monastery were chanting prayers. A few of their colleagues were working on the colorful and very complex sand mandala, adding one painstaking grain of sand at a time. Everything in the mandala, laid out meticulously on a 2-meter square wooden platform, was a symbolic representation of some aspect of the Kalachakra deity and the deity's universe. At one point, I noticed they had become agitated, whispering among themselves. They had made a small mistake. A tiny figure was inscribed in the wrong location. After making sure no one was watching, a monk surreptitiously sucked the offending grains out through a metal tube. I had seen several sand mandala being constructed, but this was the first time I had ever seen a flaw. Without the presence of the Dalai Lama, there was a palpable sense of lethargy in the air. I noticed a tiny mic affixed to the woodwork just above a window, its wire snaking through a crack to the outside. A monk told me that the wire was hooked up to an FM transmitter that fed a loudspeaker in the Dalai Lama's bedroom. Even in his weakened state, the Dalai Lama wanted to contribute. If he couldn't participate in person, he would make sure he was there in spirit. He wanted to tune in onto the monk's prayers and silently add his from afar. This collective energy, a paean to world peace, would be released when the mandala was ritually destroyed and its sand emptied into a water source. Until then, the Dalai Lama would compel himself to stay engaged, to follow the meticulous preparations from his sickbed. Picturing him there, willing himself to remain conscious to the chants, I was once again touched by his humanity. Chapter 15. A Couple of Unsigned Photographs. The lead Korean dancer was in a trance. Her eyes were closed, a crazed smile frozen on her face. She whipped her head back and forth in a frenzy, jerking violently in place to a staccato beat drummed out by her fellow dancers. There were six of them, all wearing pink silk tunics and white baggy trousers. A few had hats piled extravagantly high with pink and yellow pom-poms. The dancers were part of a sizable contingent of Korean Buddhists in Bodh Gaya for the Kalachakra initiations. After the morning teachings by a Tibetan Lama, a small group of them had decided to provide the monks with some diversion to take their minds away from the uncertainty about the Dalai Lama's condition. An old Tibetan woman appeared from nowhere. All of a sudden, she was right in the midst of the dancing Koreans. She began to sashay back and forth languidly. Once she got into the rhythm, she twisted and pirouetted energetically, flinging her arms around with abandon. She pulled out a long blue scarf, which she whipped around and around over her head, a perfect complement to her flowing Tibetan dress. The monks were enchanted. This frail and grandmotherly Tibetan, her white hair tied up in a bun, was matching the much younger Koreans beat for beat. They egged her on with shouts and catcalls. A novice monk, about 6 years of age, climbed onto the shoulders of an older monk to get a better look. A burly Indian policeman stood and stared, forgetting for the moment his job of crowd control. The old woman, a serene smile on her face, paid no attention to the people around her. An elderly Western woman, grinning hugely and shaking her head in disbelief, walked up to one of the monks. As she caught his attention, she gave him a thumbs up, then gyrated her arms and shoulders to mimic the dance of the old Tibetan woman. The monk smiled good-naturedly, patted her on the shoulder, and stuck up his own thumb. After the performance, I went back to my hotel. I sat down in the lobby and read the day's Times of India. The Karmapa had checked into the hotel a couple of days earlier, and there were many people hanging around the lobby, hoping to get a glimpse of the 17-year-old supreme head of the Kagyu sect. A couple of years earlier, the teenager had ditched his Chinese minders in his Tibet monastery, crossed the Himalayas on horseback at night in order to be with the Dalai Lama. Alan King, a Canadian who has photographed 7 Kalachakras over the past decade, slid in beside me. He leaned in close and said in a low voice, "Victor, I don't like the look of this. Tenzin Takla finally took my two photos to the Dalai Lama this morning. Half an hour ago, he gave them back to me, unsigned. King was mounting an exhibition of Kalachakra photos in Graz, Austria, and he needed autographs from the Dalai Lama. Takla had been carrying the photos in his briefcase for days. "Tenzin didn't get in to see the Dalai Lama?" I asked. "No. He saw the Dalai Lama, and he presented the photos. But he was too weak to sign them." I had been feeling uneasy about the Dalai Lama for a couple of days. When he'd appeared at the Kalachakra grounds, he had distinctly said he'd give 2 days of teachings if he recovered enough of his strength. That hadn't happened. Several top lamas had taught in his stead. The final day of the Kalachakra, when the huge crowd would dedicate long life prayers to the Dalai Lama, was just around the corner. The Dalai Lama had promised he would attend, but so far there had been no official confirmation. It was 30 years since I'd first met the Dalai Lama. In recent years, we'd flown together, broke bread together, and spent time in his residence in the wee hours of the morning. As we worked on our book, he shared his insights about forgiveness, compassion, and emptiness. Little by little, he had grown on me. By now, I saw him as a kind of father figure. Most important, I knew in my heart he cared for me. There was the time he had sent me a chair to sit on in a teaching because he sensed that my legs were not made for sitting lotus style on the floor. I knew he encouraged Tenzin Geshe to look out for me, to take me out for dinner from time to time, so that I wouldn't feel neglected. I was very moved by this knowledge. The fact that the Dalai Lama also has deep connections to so many other people in his orbit, many of them he met for the first time, didn't make much of a difference. I didn't begrudge their good fortune. It was enough for me to experience his profound warmth once in a while. I had been devastated to see him so weakened at the Kalachakra grounds. In a span of 10 days, he had aged 10 years. And now Alan King was telling me that the Dalai Lama was too weak to pick up a pen. I left the Mahayana and walked the short distance to the Mahabodhi Temple. Walking clockwise around the central tower, I began my ritual circumambulation, jostled and pushed along by a large crowd of pilgrims. I stopped at a small open area on the south side of the complex. There, thousands upon thousands of candles and butter lamps burnt on stone altars and any other available surface. I bought a small package of candles from the caretaker. I lit one with a tinder, melted the wax at the bottom, then stuck it onto a stone ledge. As I did, I offered a silent prayer for the Dalai Lama. Then I lit the rest of the candles. After completing the pilgrim circuit, I headed back to the hotel. Just before I got there, I ran into Tenzin Takla, hurrying in the opposite direction. I was glad to see him. I wanted the latest update about the Dalai Lama's condition. Tenzin slowed down but didn't stop. "I can't talk now," he said tersely. "I have just been on the phone with the Prime Minister. We're evacuating the Dalai Lama first thing tomorrow morning." In a daze, I walked into the hotel lobby. It was still full of people waiting for the Karmapa to emerge. A small group of Westerners sat on couches near the back. A tall American was showing the others stunning black-and-white pictures of eastern Tibet on a laptop. Someone cracked a joke, and everyone laughed. Werner Herzog, the legendary filmmaker from Germany, passed through with his film crew and his willowy young wife. He had come here to make a documentary of the Kalachakra. I went back into my room, closed the curtains, and lay down. I could hear the churning of the large crowd out on the streets, pilgrims heading to the temple, pilgrims leaving the temple to go back to their lodgings. I was expecting Singe Rabten, the Dalai Lama's chief bodyguard. Every day around this time, he came to my room to use the shower, since there was no hot water at Shechen Monastery. But Rabten never did show up that day. It was early morning in Bodh Gaya. I had made sure to arrive at Shechen well ahead of the Dalai Lama's scheduled departure time. The news that he was being evacuated to a private hospital in Bombay had spread, and the street leading to the monastery was completely clogged. There was anxiety in the air. No one knew how sick the Dalai Lama really was. There was little hard news, but plenty of rumor. The fact that he'd been hospitalized for the first time in over 3 decades sent shockwaves throughout the Tibetan community. Scores of policemen and soldiers were busy trying to keep the huge horde away from the entrance. As I walked into the monastery, I was surprised to see the Queen of Bhutan, unobtrusive in her striped Bhutanese dress, standing forlorn among the crowd. A couple of policemen, obviously unaware of who she was, unceremoniously shoved her to the back. The courtyard outside the temple was also crowded. The chief magistrate of the town of Gaya was conferring with several of his senior police officers. Off by themselves in a small group were the crack Indian commandos, intimidating and handsome in their all-black ninja outfits. Less exalted soldiers, wearing khaki and blue berets, stood around in knots. Lakdor was there as well, looking out of place in his maroon robes. Flashing my inner circle pass, I walked into the cramped lobby of the monastery. A dozen of the most eminent lamas of Tibetan Buddhism had gathered on couches in the small sitting area. A trio of orange-robed Sri Lankan monks, administrators of the Mahabodhi Temple, sat among them. Trulshik Rinpoche, the last living tutor of the Dalai Lama, came down the stairs. The frail and gentle monk had no doubt been bidding farewell to the Dalai Lama. I stood to one side of the lobby and waited.
End of Disc 4. Disc 5.
I stood to one side of the lobby and waited. Before long, I saw the Dalai Lama slowly descending the stairs. His faithful attendant of many years, Paljorla, held him up by his left armpit. Singe Rabten had his hands in a vice grip around the Dalai Lama's right elbow. The Dalai Lama looked haggard, but no more so than when I'd last seen him. However, he apparently had continued to lose weight. When the Tibetan leader reached the lobby, he went up to the waiting lamas. As was his habit, he kidded around and teased them. He rubbed the head of one and poked someone else in the chest. Even in his weakened state, he still wanted to make them feel good, to lighten their grief. He knew that they were traumatized by his condition. As he shuffled toward the entrance, the Dalai Lama caught sight of me, half hidden behind some security guards. For a couple of heartbeats, he paused and looked at me steadily. He didn't smile. His eyes simply locked onto mine. I found myself going red. My jaw muscles clenched. The Dalai Lama came forward and embraced me gently. Tears streamed down my face, wetting the fabric of his robes as I held on to him. He finally pulled away, looked into my teary eyes once more, and walked out into the courtyard. Chapter 16. All the Selfish Buddhas. Lakdor sat stiffly on the edge of the couch. The monk translator was unaccustomedly quiet. It was 4:30 in the morning. Maybe it was too early for him. Drolma, the Dalai Lama's German shepherd, lay curled up next to him. She was oblivious to our intrusion into her living area. Her stainless steel food and water bowls were on the floor next to the couch. It was late March 2002, 2.5 months after the Dalai Lama had gotten seriously ill in Bodh Gaya. Lakdor and I were in the ground floor sitting room of the Dalai Lama's private quarters in Dharamsala. We were about to have a rendezvous with the Tibetan leader. For the first time since his sickness, he was strong enough to receive visitors, and for the second time in 3 years, I had been given the rare privilege of accompanying the Dalai Lama on his morning walk. I would see for myself whether he had truly recovered. The sitting room's rattan furniture and area carpets were dowdy and a bit worse for wear. An oil portrait of the Dalai Lama, painted years ago by the looks of it, hung on one wall. A painting of an endless knot, floating in a New Age blue ether, propped against the legs of a table. It was obvious that the room was seldom used. The Dalai Lama had few reasons to come down here. Everything he needed, His meditation room, his study, his dining room was on the second floor, and he almost always preferred to meet visitors in the audience hall complex farther down the hill in the residential compound. One thing that struck me about the sitting room was its bunker-like feel. The building was clearly designed to be earthquake-resistant, perhaps even earthquake-proof. Massive concrete beams girded this bottom floor. The room's low ceiling accentuated its claustrophobic feel. At precisely 4:40 a.m., a Tibetan bodyguard came in to tell us that the Dalai Lama was on his way downstairs. We left the room and hurried outside. The pleasantly cool night air was heavy with the scent of exotic flowers. Nearly all of the available space in the entrance courtyard was crammed with potted plants, masses of purple and dark blue blossoms, set off by taller reds in the back. The entire two-story residence was lit up like a ship on high seas, bathing the surrounding grounds with light. Half a dozen Tibetan bodyguards hung around the entrance, while everyone else in Dharamsala slept. This secluded enclave was alive with subdued, purposeful activity. The Dalai Lama slowly walked down the heavily reinforced external stairs. He was wearing his monk's robes, but had left the outer shawl behind. His shoulders and arms were bare. After nodding to Luckdor, he leaned in close to peer at me, straightened up, boomed a hearty, "Ni hao," his standard greeting for me in Chinese, and walked off at a brisk pace. It had been more than 2 months since I'd last seen him. At the time, he had been shuffling laboriously out of Shechin Monastery in Bodh Gaya, en route to the small Gaya airport. A helicopter had been on standby to take him to one of the best hospitals in India. On this early spring morning, however, he looked alert and vital, if a touch gaunt. There seemed no doubt that he had recovered from his debilitating illness. Two Indian officers in khaki and windbreakers appeared from nowhere and took off after him. The Tibetan bodyguards, Luckdor and I, brought up the rear. We soon left the eerie glow cast by the residence behind. Walking along a wide concrete path, we passed a long, narrow greenhouse. Then we headed up into a dark, heavily wooded area. A lone Indian sentry, wearing a short overcoat against the cold, stood at attention next to a concrete shelter, his rifle smartly cradled against his side. The Dalai Lama walked up to him, playfully tugged at his rifle, and said good morning. The soldier seemed used to this routine. He kept his eyes fixed at a level spot in front of him and said crisply, "Good morning, sir." We skirted the bottom of a small hill topped with prayer flags and a white stupa. The path narrowed as we approached the audience hall complex. It was pitch dark in this area. A bodyguard had gone on ahead and turned on his powerful flashlight, illuminating the path and the bougainvillea-clad veranda. The Dalai Lama rounded a circular driveway and headed uphill to his private chapel. From the other side of the building, a steep path descending through thick woods led back down to the residence. The Dalai Lama slowed to a crawl during the last section, mincing his steps as he negotiated the tricky incline in the dim light. Then, we were back where we had started. I was pleasantly surprised when the Dalai Lama turned around to begin another circuit. The first time I had accompanied him on one of these early morning jaunts, he had walked to a point just beyond the greenhouse and then turned back, covering in total a distance not much greater than the width of a football field. In the 2 years since then, I have often nagged him about the importance of exercise, and I was gratified that he had taken it seriously. On that morning, the Dalai Lama completed 3 circuits in all. At the end of his regime, he said goodbye to us and went back upstairs to take a shower and have breakfast. The walk had taken nearly half an hour, and I was sweating in spite of the cool mountain air. Even from the little I had seen of the Dalai Lama in the dim pre-dawn light, I could tell he had lost weight. Not a surprise, given that he had been bedridden for most of January and February. In a few hours, I was scheduled to begin another series of interviews with him. I was keen to quiz him about his illness. When I walked into the audience hall that afternoon, I was pleasantly surprised to see Nari Rinpoche there with Luckdor. The Tibetan leader's youngest brother didn't sit in on all my interviews, but the odd times he did, usually at the request of His Holiness, his highly developed sense of humor helped take the edge off my nervousness. The Dalai Lama came into the room shortly afterward, right on time as usual. He sat down in his armchair and looked at me expectantly. "How are you feeling now?" I began.
"Okay. Only problem, gas," he replied.
"Distension of the abdomen, lots of gas," Nari Rinpoche elaborated.
"Gas increase, then sometimes a little sore. But walk, no problem," the Dalai Lama said.
I noticed he was sitting on the edge of his armchair rather than leaning back against it as he usually did. And his English was noticeably more choppy. I was particularly interested to know what had happened to the Dalai Lama after our pilgrimage to the ruins of Nalanda and to Vulture's Peak. He told me that he had developed acute stomach pain well before the motorcade reached Patna. The pain was so severe that he'd curled up into a tight ball. Trying to get comfortable, he'd shifted positions, leaning against the car door facing first one way and then the other. Finally, he gave up and settled on his left side, slumping his head and shoulder against the handrest. Every bump of the road sent an excruciating jolt through his body. His eyes were closed, and he was sweating profusely in spite of the air conditioning turned up high. Before the interview with the Dalai Lama, I had spoken to M.K. Bhutia, the liaison officer charged with looking after the logistics of the Tibetan leader's tours. I wanted to know about the car ride from Nalanda to Patna. Bhutia had accompanied the Dalai Lama during his many trips in India, but he had never seen him in such a state of agony. Mild diarrhea or a cold, yes, but never like this. The Dalai Lama was hunched up like a sick dog, and Patna was still an hour away. Bhutia radioed the lead police escort of the convoy, telling him about the problem. The motorcade sped up, siren blaring and lights flashing. Cars and lorries pulled to the side of the road to allow the dozen-odd cars to pass. The increased speed smoothed out some of the potholes, and that seemed to make the Dalai Lama feel slightly better. On the outskirts of Patna, however, the convoy had slowed to a crawl. The road was choked with early evening traffic, and the din was horrendous. Every driver, or so it seemed to the Dalai Lama, was leaning on his horn. Even with the police escort, there was no way for the convoy to go any faster. It was wedged tightly among several diesel-belching buses and darting three-wheelers. Because of the frequent stops and starts, the Dalai Lama started to feel sick to his stomach. He managed to prop himself up into a sitting position, and he found that his nausea eased when he could look out the window. That was when he saw an old man and a young boy by the side of the road.
"I was very painful, very, very painful," the Dalai Lama described the scene to me in the audience hall.
Nari Rinpoche hung on to his every word. He had not heard these details from him before.
"Then, all this liquid, water, sweat. This time I noticed, water from eyes, much connected with emotion. Water from body, much connected with physical pain. So, when very serious physical pain comes, no water from eyes, only from body. What's the difference? What's the connection? I don't know. Then I saw one old person with long, untrimmed hair." The Dalai Lama passed his right hand over the crown of his head. Spreading his thumb and little finger wide, he gave me an idea of how long the old man's hair had been. "And beard, completely disheveled. Wearing clothes soaked with dust and filth." He grimaced as he recalled the disturbing image. "Then, so many poor children, no education, living by the side of the road. I noticed one this size." The Dalai Lama extended his arm to indicate a height of 3 to 4 feet. He then reached down to touch his shins with both hands. Suffering from polio, both his legs having clamps, and he was using crutches. "So, while I had this physical pain, in my eyes, there was only the image of these poor people. No one cared for them while I was getting good care."
The Dalai Lama closed his eyes and fell silent. After a few moments, he continued, "Although I felt physical pain, mentally, no anxiety, quite peaceful. Just felt a little inconvenience. Why that peaceful feeling? I myself get physical pain, but mentally, constantly feeling about these other people who have no care. Therefore, not much worry about my own pain. Concern for others seems to help lessen my own pain. The experience of generating compassion is something very beneficial to oneself, not necessarily beneficial to others. I reflected on the terrible condition of the old man, the boy with polio. My sense of concern reduced the feeling of my own physical pain. So, very good." "Is this what you have in mind," I asked the Dalai Lama, "when you say in teachings that the Buddhas and Bodhisattvas of the world are the most selfish beings of all, that by cultivating altruism, they actually achieve ultimate happiness for themselves?" "Yes, that's wise selfish," he replied. "Helping others not means we do this at our own expense, not like this. Buddhas and Bodhisattvas, these people very wise. All their lives, they only want one thing, to achieve ultimate happiness. How to do this? By cultivating compassion, by cultivating altruism. When they care for others, they themselves are the first to benefit. They are first to get maximum happiness. They know best way to lead happy life is help others. That's real wisdom. They don't think, oh, I'm most important, other people not so important. Not that way. Intentionally, they consider others' well-being to be the most important. And in reality, this action returns maximum benefit to them." A thought occurred to the Dalai Lama. He turned to Nari Rinpoche and said in English, "I think cook." He trailed off into Tibetan. His youngest brother translated. "A cook who cooks for others, even though he doesn't have the intention of cooking for himself, is always well fed." "Many cooks very fat, I noticed," the Dalai Lama added. He and his brother had a good laugh over this. "So did your pain actually go away when you saw those poor people in Patna?" I wanted to know. "No, I don't think," the Dalai Lama said. "But these mental pictures of what I saw, the poverty and helplessness, they were very sharp. Even when I lay in my Patna hotel bed, I was in pain, but all I saw was those two. Hungry, thirsty. Over and over in my mind I asked, 'What a pity! What can we do? What can we do?' So the intensity of my pain reduced. Something like being overwhelmed by strong concern." Chapter 17. The Coldness of Blueberries. Ever since I left Bodh Gaya, I had been obsessed with a nagging question: how the Dalai Lama's stomach pains could escalate into a full-blown crisis, precipitating his evacuation to a specialist hospital in Bombay. I wanted to explore the causes of his illness with the Dalai Lama. "Did you feel bad when you walked up the steep hill to Vulture's Peak?" I asked him in his audience room. Nari Rinpoche moved his straight-backed chair a little closer to his brother. He hadn't gone to Vulture's Peak with us, and he was interested to know what had transpired before the onset of the Dalai Lama's pain. "No," the Dalai Lama replied. "I didn't feel bad that morning. Nothing. Very fresh. But then, inside, already some causes and conditions. Did you eat something bad at the Japanese hotel in Rajgir?"
"I don't think so."
"But you had diarrhea after having lunch at the hotel."
"Dysentery."
"I heard from Dr. Setin that there were amoebas in your stomach. They must have come from bad food or bad water."
"I don't know," the Dalai Lama replied. "How long the amoebas in my stomach, I don't know.
Not necessarily come that very day. There are many causes. One, the immediate cause, is carelessness."
"Carelessness?"
"Carelessness because generally my body okay, then I thought." The Dalai Lama looked over to Lakhdar and switched to Tibetan. "His Holiness felt he was very healthy, so he kept pushing himself, doing too much, traveling too much," Lakhdar translated.
Less caution, the Dalai Lama explained.
People who work closely with the Dalai Lama would agree with this sentiment wholeheartedly. He keeps a punishing schedule, especially when he is on the road. I have traveled with him enough times to know this for myself. I'm 10 years younger, but his energy and stamina put me to shame. Keeping up with him is definitely not a walk in the park.
Then, morning walk up Vulture's Peak? Lots of sweat, the Dalai Lama continued. On top of mountain? Little bit cold. Go back down, sweating again. Then lunchtime, took off clothes. After lunch, took fresh lemon and water. Usually no problem, but that day, because something already disturbed, then that became one of the factors. A more substantial cause. Before I went on pilgrimage to Vulture's Peak in Nalanda, I first went to South India to give teachings. While I was there, I started taking one Tibetan medicine for liver and for eyes. It is a cold medicine. It gives coldness to the body. Some 30 years ago, I took that same medication for liver problem and immediately little pain started here in my stomach. I discontinued and took medicine to generate heat instead. Pain disappeared completely. Now this time, exactly same place. So, too much cold. Too much cold. That was what my mother used to tell me whenever I was sick. It didn't matter much what my symptoms were. The problem was always cold vapors. She'd drag me clear across Hong Kong Island by tram to outlying West Point, where we'd walk up a steep, narrow lane paved with uneven stone steps to an herbalist's shop. The place was dimly lit, and most of its available wall space was lined with bank upon bank of small rosewood drawers, all filled with herbs. The herbalist would take my pulse, peer at my tongue, write up a prescription with brush and ink, and weigh out herbs from the drawers. Back at our flat, my mother would boil and reduce the herbs for a couple of hours until the resultant broth was the blackest shade of black. The medicine, though bitter, was not entirely unpleasant. I had to drink the whole thing down in one go while it was piping hot. Usually I got better quite soon after, perhaps in spite of the medicine, I liked to think. Like Chinese medicine, like Indian Ayurvedic medicine, Tibetan medicine usually divided into hot and cold, the Dalai Lama elaborated. Most illnesses of lower body are connected with too much cold. Liver problems, headaches, mean too much heat. So for 3 weeks in South India, every morning, I took that medicine which increased coldness in my body. Little pain occasionally already started. Then, during the pilgrimage, immediate causes happened. Then something burst. Now, another factor, he continued. Last May, when I was in America, my digestion system very good, excellent. So, during breakfast, I took a lot of cold milk. Then in Salt Lake City, one lady, she told me blueberries very good for eyes. She told me American Air Force pilots usually eat lots of blueberry jam. So I took some blueberries, quite tasty. Then day by day increased. That affected digestion system to some extent. Too much cold. The Dalai Lama spoke briefly to Lakhdar. It seems that was how the whole thing started, Lakhdar translated, because of the cold of the blueberries. So it was the coldness of the blueberries that triggered the crisis. It was not quite the answer I'd expected. But then, I'd reconciled myself to the fact that the Dalai Lama is not like you and me. He has a significantly different way of looking at the world around him. There were still a few things about the illness that I wanted to know. What happened when you were in Bodh Gaya? I asked the Dalai Lama, after you came back from Patna. For 4-5 days in Shechin, not much improvement. Therefore I thought, if Kalachakra started, if one started then failed, then worse. Therefore, it's better to cancel, postpone. Then I decided. At beginning, still hoped to give 3 days of teachings, but couldn't do it. Then one morning, Dr. Settin noticed this side of body swollen, the Dalai Lama said, patting the left side of his abdomen. He suggested that His Holiness go to the hospital that very day, Lakhdar said.
"That's why you had to cancel the long life prayers on the last day of the Kalachakra?" I asked.
"Yes," the Dalai Lama said. "That very day, impossible to arrange travels. Then, tried to find out whether possible to leave for the Bombay hospital the next day. Some contact with Delhi. State government agreed to provide one helicopter. The central government provided one special flight from Patna to Bombay directly. In Bombay, from airport, direct to hospital."
When His Holiness walked into the hospital, Nari Rinpoche said to me, unprompted, the first thing he saw was the IV bottle and the big needle waiting for him. He felt uncomfortable. He was a little scared. Although Nari Rinpoche was there mainly to help Lakdor with the translation, I could always trust him to come up with some interesting tidbits. "But there was no choice, so I had to take the IV," the Dalai Lama said, grimacing slightly at the memory. "What tests did they do in the hospital?" I asked.
"They checked everything. The stomach, intestine, of course, but also the heart, liver, blood. Nothing wrong. No cancer."
"But what caused the swelling?" I asked.
"They're unable to trace it. Although one specialist told me," the Dalai Lama trailed off again into Tibetan.
After he examined His Holiness, Nari Rinpoche translated, the specialist said things were completely okay. No sign of cancer. Then he mentioned, this was serious illness. It could have killed him. There was a tiny perforation of the intestine, and if it was bigger, it could have killed him.
I glanced at the Dalai Lama, who had the ghost of a smile on his face. It was as if he was secretly amused that he could have died.
A couple of monks came into the audience room bringing trays. One monk carefully set a lidded cup of hot water next to the Dalai Lama. Another placed a tray with a jar of instant Nescafe, some tea bags, and a thermos of hot water on the low table next to me. As silently as they had come, they left the room. Nari Rinpoche got up from his chair, walked over, and whispered into my ear, would you like coffee or tea? I kept my eyes on the Dalai Lama. Coffee, please. I was vaguely aware of Rinpoche putting a heaping teaspoon of Nescafe into a cup and then filling it with hot water. He leaned close to me and whispered into my ears again. Milk? Sugar? Sure, thank you, I replied automatically. As I flipped through my pages of typed questions, a touch of panic gripped me. I had lost the place of my last question, and I had no idea what I was supposed to ask the Dalai Lama next. Coffee was always enormously welcome. Midway through a 2-hour-plus interview, my energies tended to flag. But sometimes, the interruption could knock me off my tenuous focus. Then I remembered something Dr. Setin had mentioned to me in a conversation. Dr. Setin told me that the Indian doctors in Bombay said your heart is like that of a 20-year-old's, I said to the Dalai Lama.
Yes, that's right, he replied. After doing the ECG tests, the Bombay doctors informed me. Actually, the Patna doctor who examined me said exactly the same thing.
What do you think is a reason for this? I asked as I gulped down my instant coffee greedily.
I think peace of mind, the Dalai Lama said without hesitation.
Your heart is like a 20-year-old's because you have peace of mind?
Yes, the Dalai Lama was emphatic. Otherwise, there is nothing special about me. I don't do any special exercises.
A 67-year-old man with the heart of a 20-year-old. The Dalai Lama has no doubt that the mind has the power to heal the body. To him, the mind and the body belong to an inseparable continuum. When something happens to one, the other is affected. The interdependence of all things has been the Dalai Lama's mantra for half a century. Nowadays, even mainstream doctors and researchers